The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Shannon D, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you will be given a 5-minute and a 1-minute reminder when it is time to wrap up your talk. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Ann P.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann. I'm an alcoholic. Let's see here. First off, I want to thank Marty. Can you hear me okay, everybody? Yeah. Okay. So I want to thank everybody who was on the team this year. God, what a year. I want to thank Marty, my buddy. I've known him for 30 years. Julie, good friend of mine. Our daughters were in gymnastics together. I want to thank Valerie for coming in and helping me with the birthdays. And I want to do a big shout out to my friend Andrea, listening in from Columbus, Ohio. She and I were best friends in Columbus, Ohio. We met when we were 6 years old. She's coming up on a year of sobriety, July 11th, 7-11. Anyway. Okay. So I was born and raised in the Midwest. I was born on a farm, believe it or not. And I was raised on a farm with the whole nine yards, the chickens and some livestock. But anyway, my mom and dad are both alcoholics. They have since died. They didn't die of alcoholism, though. I have a sister, two sisters and a brother. All of us are in recovery. And we moved to the big city of Columbus, Ohio. And yeah, I mean, I took my first drink. Actually, I think it was with Andrea. We were over at Monette's house, and she gave us a couple of Little Kings. It's a type of beer. And we drank them. And, you know, Clancy would always talk about that warm feeling that, you know, that goes down into your stomach and then just makes its way out to your limbs. And I totally felt that. And we ran outside. This is my first memory of it. And we were hanging around on the trees and stuff. Gosh, we must have been, God, I don't know, 10 or 11, 12, maybe. And that just started my little career. And, you know, my dad was, you know, pretty violent alcoholic. He would, him and my mom loved to go to the bars, and they would come home and there'd always be some kind of drama going on. And, you know, it wasn't fun. You know, the bills wouldn't be paid, things like that. So, yeah. So I just kind of lived, you know, talk about living in the moment, you know, didn't really have a choice. Things were pretty crazy at the house. And then I remember being in middle school. We called it junior high back then. And I wanted to try out for cheerleading. And I just didn't think I was good enough, but I did it. And I just wanted to be like mainstream, like everybody else. And so I did that, actually got in, and I felt like on the normal side of society for some weird reason. And so I really loved that. And then, but then, you know, I started to smoke pot around that time, some outside issues. And it wasn't anything, I didn't really cross any invisible lines until I got to high school. And I was in high school in the 70s. And, you know, we were very much into the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of thing back then. I remember bands would come into Columbus, and we would, I'd had Andrea's sister Della, we would go and get backstage passes. And I remember going to Rush when the 2112 album came out. And oh my God, it was insane. I won't tell you the details, but let's just say, you know, it was a night to remember. But you know, it was fun. I mean, that's when things were working. So I thought. I was also a bar drinker in Columbus. They have a lot of bars in the campus area. And I'll just skip right up to the 80s. I went from being a little rock and roll chick to the punk scene kind of happened upon, like, you know, in the early 80s, late 70s, I'm really aging myself. But anyway, so there was this punk bar called Crazy Mamas, and I literally would hang out there all the time. And that's where I met my husband, Ron. He was in his last month of medical school, and I was a dance major at Ohio State University, completely failing out. Drinking copious amounts of beer over at Crazy Mama's, going into blackouts. You know, the bars in Ohio wouldn't close to like 2, 2:30. And then I still wasn't satisfied. You know, I would look for, you know, we'd try to find like a six pack and then maybe go to, you know, people's houses and drink. I mean, that was pretty much my life for many years. I always felt like a freak. I always felt like I was always on the periphery of life. I never felt like I fit in. And, you know, the Brady Bunch, for some reason, I always thought that, okay, thank you. I always thought that that's the kind of family, you know, that you should be or whatever, you know, and I just always felt less than. So I moved out to LA in 1984 with Ron, and, you know, I'm going to SMC, finally get into UCLA. Believe it or not, still drinking and using. And then the outside issues of cocaine, you know, kind of came into play in the 80s. People were dying left and right from their hearts exploding from so much cocaine. But anyway, it was my last year at UCLA, and my husband finally gave me an ultimatum. He said, you know, I can't live this way anymore. You know, I'd get on my moped and I'd drive down to the Ore House. And I never got a DUI, but, you know, because that moped probably didn't go more than 35 miles an hour. But it reminded me of Ohio, reminded me of the sawdust on the floors and the foosball tables. Andrea and I used to play a lot of foosball. We were really good, still are to this day. But anyway, so gave me an ultimatum. And then right around that time, my sister called me out of the blue, Melissa. And she said, you know what, I'm coming to LA. And she had like 16 years of sobriety at the time. Or 9 years. And she came out, she called central office, and Diana, who's actually taking a cake tonight, I know because I'm the cake lady, directed Melissa to the Pacific Group. And Melissa went and she came home. It was the Wednesday night meeting. She's like, oh my God, Ann, you got to check this out. It's crazy. There's like, seems like 1,000 people there, and they're all bright and shiny and wearing suits, and the girls are all cleaned up and like they're acting like ladies. I mean, it's just insane. And I was just like, really? It was, talk about program of attraction. I know what Melissa was trying to do. She was trying to kind of egg me on, you know. But anyway, I decided to go. And so I went, and it was crazy. I mean, there were so many people. The buzz in the room at the Pacific Group was like, well, you guys know, you know, and hopefully we'll soon feel that again. It was electrifying, you know, and I reached a certain point that I knew it was over. I just knew it was time for me to clock out, you know, and because I had dreams, I wanted to dance, and you can't dance when you're drunk, you know. So anyway, so April 5th, 1991 is my sobriety date. And I got Marianne King as my, no, actually it was Jill B first as my sponsor. And I was a big liar. I lied all the time about the most stupidest things. And so Jill fired me, and she should have. And then I got Marianne King. Marianne King took me through 16 years of, Marianne is the type of person that always says, it's been my experience. She doesn't necessarily give me direction, but that was basically code for, you better do it. And so I followed her direction. I did the fourth. She took me through the steps. She was, and we all know this, Marianne is a woman who walks the walk and literally talks the talk. And then I got Diane G as my sponsor. She's my current sponsor, and she has kids. They're grown like my kids are now. But she took me through the steps again over at Judy Ross's house when I was going through some things. And Diane is one of these women who we all know, who also walks the walk and talks the talk. She's just, I'm so incredibly grateful for women in the Pacific Group that have really showed me how to be a woman, who have who have told me things that I don't want to hear, you know. And my sister Melissa, who was my Eskimo, said, you know what, Anne, never forget your primary purpose is to stay sober and help others to achieve sobriety. And I'll never forget that, you know. Today, my husband and I are separated, but both my children are doing really well. One's in college in Hawaii, must be nice. And the other one is here in LA, and I call her my pandemic COVID buddy. We've weathered this storm this past 15 months. And I sponsor my best friend, Andrea, and she also has a sponsor in Ohio. And I get to be of service to some women in the group. And, you know, it's made me the woman who I am today. Am I perfect? No. But you know what? All I do is just try to get through one day to the next. And I really, really look forward to seeing everybody in person, hopefully in the next few months. And I just, again, want to thank Marty for doing a really great job this year. Woo, woo. And thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Our main speaker tonight is Johnny H.
My name's Johnny Harris. I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here tonight. Glad to be sober. I want to thank Marty for extending the privilege to me participating in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I've always felt some kind of way, and I hope I never change my thought about this. There's some type of a privilege to be allowed to come and sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope I don't ever get it to my sick head that I have a right to everything that goes on here just because I put the plug in the jug and haven't drank for a long, long time. It's a blessing to be this. And the thing I'm grateful for tonight is I sit and look at the screen of all the people that I miss seeing on Wednesday night. Wednesday's been a tough day for me for the last year or so, because I spent so much time sitting alongside of the old man and lunching and all that kind of stuff with him. And coming and being without you on these troubling times, it was kind of a pitfall. And another reason is that I am computer illiterate and I have to have help to do anything on a computer. And so I've been blessed by people that I sponsor and my lovely wife and people like that to make sure I get to my meetings on Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and whenever I'm asked to speak anywhere. So I'm grateful for a lot of things. I'm grateful for that. I'm in a way, I'm kind of grateful for this COVID thing, whatever it is, because it has done something for me. It's made me a little closer to the people that I sponsor, because I get to meet with them from time to time, and they come by, and Ron comes over here every Thursday night. So I just think it's good. I'm one of those kind of guys that sit around and mope about it because we've got this thing going on, because there's still newcomers. We got people in our group that have never been to a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but they're taking birthday cakes for 1 year and stuff like that. It's a great thing to see. So, and I want to commend the crew to put this meeting on this year, because I think you've all done a tremendous job. It's more than I could have ever handled, I'll tell you that. And I'm just very pleased to be a part of all that, part of all you, because I know all of you so well. But I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I don't know why I was born with this illness. I don't understand it. They say that maybe only 1 out of 10 people who drink are alcoholic of my type. But I was born with this funny feeling inside of me that I felt guilty about everything. Before I knew, I was guilty. I didn't like where I was. I didn't like the family I had. I didn't like anything about my life whatsoever. And so from my first beginning of understanding, I've been looking for a way out of this dilemma that I was in. Now, it's hard to seek the answer to a problem if you don't know what your problem is. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just didn't have the slightest idea. So I reached out for everything that I could to try to find what was wrong with me. My grandmother was my first object, because my grandmother lived till she was 90 years old, and she never took a drink of alcohol or smoked a cigarette in her entire life. I guess some meetings she'd go to, she could take a cake for 90 years, so just, but she don't go to meetings, or she didn't. which my grandmother used to take care of this family, this Irish family that I was born into. And they drunk and they beat each other up and they stole each other's whiskey and women. And my grandfather was a bootlegger. It was just kind of a, I guess it would be described as dysfunctional today if you was going to get one of those kind of things. But it wasn't bad because the people who lived next door were doing the same thing my family was doing. But my grandmother, every Sunday morning, got up in the middle of this mess that my family created and took off, was gone for a couple of hours. And when she came back, something had happened to her. I could see it as clearly as I can see you on the screen. She was a little lighter in her step, a little easier in her being. And she kind of danced around these people and cleaned them up and sang songs to Jesus. And that looked very appealing to me. So I thought, I'm going to go where my grandma goes and do what my grandma does. And I'd be like my grandma. Well, I went where my grandma went and I did what my grandma was. But I wasn't like my grandma because my grandmother was an alcoholic. And I didn't know that. I just knew that wherever my grandma was getting in that church that she took me to, I wasn't getting it because I walked out of there with more guilt than I walked in with. And I didn't know what to do. But what it was, my first attempt to get out of this dilemma that I was in, my first attempt was a big disappointment in that church. It had nothing to do with the church. It had something to do with me. Because I'm looking for something way outside of me to make me feel better inside. And I didn't understand that. I didn't understand what was wrong with me. And so I was disappointed in that church. But that was the beginning of many, many, many disappointments on this search that I made, that I was making to try to find out what was wrong with me. I found out some of it as a little boy sitting on the back porch watching my grandfather drink his bootleg whiskey. He put it down and went somewhere, and I picked it up and took a drink of it. That's all I did. I didn't understand what it was. But I just know that that stuff went down inside of me and changed my whole outlook on life. I wasn't guilty anymore. I wasn't doing that. I knew I wasn't good enough to be around the good people, but I knew I was too good to be around the bad people. It was okay right where I was at. But I wasn't ready for what happened to me next because it doesn't happen to everybody who drinks. Not even heavy drinkers get it. What happens to me when I drink? I guess maybe 1 out of 10 people who drink get this, according to everything I've ever heard. Once I take a drink of alcohol, I am powerless not to take the next one. I'm powerless. And my any drunk that I take after I take a drink of alcohol ended up the same way for the next 20 years. I was pulled off from underneath the bridge on my way to my grandma's house and sat in front of a judge and sentenced to reform school in Hutchinson, Kansas, where I lived. And I went there. It wasn't very long till my mother came and got me and put me in a car with my two brothers and brought us to California. And on the way to California, she said to me, when we get to California, things are going to be different. Well, I got some type of hope about that, that maybe this is going to be the answer. And when I got to California, nothing changed. Because if nothing changes, nothing changes. And so I did what I was trained to do in reform school. I went out on the streets and continued my not nonsense and destruction of self out there. And I ended up in juvenile hall in 1941 when they bombed Pearl Harbor. And what I did in juvenile hall is I joined a gang, guys, that just brought me in and treated me like her, told me to do things. And I involved myself in this bunch of guys for a long, long time, doing a lot of things that I wasn't capable of doing. And then in 1951, on my way to the penitentiary for the first time, people like me who live in the streets don't stay out of jail. If you got somebody who's claiming about how bad they were out there on them streets and doing all this, I just talked to them very simply. I tell them you're either a liar or a stool pigeon. one or the other, because you can't commit a life like that out there on the streets without getting arrested. Not the way I did it, anyhow. I ended up on my way to the penitentiary in 1951, and while I'm waiting to go to the penitentiary, my mother come to visit me and screamed at me through the visiting screen in the Los Angeles County Jail. "Look what you've done now, scum. You've killed our baby." It seemed that my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison, took an overdose of it, and died. And 3 or 4 days later, I stood handcuffed with two detectives out near in a gravesite while they buried my baby brother. And I had all the guilt and shame and fine, but I was as far as I am across the room on the other side of the grave from my mother. And my mother sat there and stared at me with all the hate that she could deal with in her life. I stared at it, and it never left her till the day she died. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I knew I was supposed to be doing something, but you see, my image had gotten so big with these people that I was running with. They were standing around watching what this crazy white man was going to do. And I stood there, and I couldn't cry, I couldn't sob, I couldn't go over to my mother because I was handcuffed away from her. And so I just went on to the penitentiary and stayed there a few years and came out of there a few years sicker than I was when I went in there. Because all I ever did when I was locked up was play baseball. It didn't make any difference. Something happened to me when I was on a baseball diamond. It took away some of the crazy that was going guilt in my head. But I got out of the penitentiary after a period of time. And I got some kind of an idea that I was just going to drink. And so it wasn't very long after that that I'm 128 pounds, strapped down on a bed in the Los Angeles County Jail with a doctor standing at the foot of my bed telling me I'm going to die. Now, I was 26 years old, and that message to me from that doctor was a blessing to me. It seemed like a good idea that I didn't have to put up with it anymore. I didn't have to ever look at my mother's eyes and see that hate that I put in there. I never wanted to ever do that again in my life. I couldn't live with it. That's why I had nightmares for years and years and years when I didn't have some type of high-powered sedative in my system. And I didn't know what to do about it. So I laid in that bed for a period of time every night, day in and day out, waiting to die, I guess. I sure wasn't waiting to get up and go somewhere. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I probably ever said in my life. I said, "Oh, God, help me." There was no blinding flashes of light. I didn't walk out of the jailhouse and have the charges dropped. Not at all. I just went to sleep for a little while. And I got better and better and better. And here's the dilemma with me. And that stuck. Two weeks after that prayer, my deathbed, I'm up running around the jail looking for some more of the poison, put me back on the bed I just gotten off of. But something happened to me during the next couple of years that I hope nobody ever has to experience it in their life. I thought for 2 years that I had gone too far, that I had gone places that people like me should never take themselves, doing things that people like me should never do to other people, and that God didn't want anything to do with me because I had gone too far. And I walked in that dilemma for 2 years until November the 4th, 1959, sitting in a penitentiary. I looked up one day from this little knoll where my partners and I were sitting waiting for the connection. We saw some people walk across the yard headed for an old Quonset hut of a building. And I followed them to that Quonset hut of a building, which is the beginning of the answer to that prayer. I didn't know that, because it didn't look like an answer to a prayer. It looked like a bunch of people who come to the penitentiary and look down on people because they had nothing better to do to look at the animals in the cages. But I went in and sat on the back row, and I saw two big A's up on the backboard, and I didn't know what it was. And I said to the guy sitting next to me, "What is this?" He said, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." Well, I sunk down in my seat because I didn't want anybody to be a gangster, to be seen in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with people trying to get better. I'm perfectly willing to die, but I didn't want to get any better, for God's sake. And so I didn't understand what was going on there. And so I don't know, I found out that the same people or a different group of people come up there every week. And so I went there. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're an alcoholic of my type, this is the dilemma I was in. These people got up and talked about things like this. I used to drink. Now I don't drink anymore. And everything is wonderful. Well, my mind, my sick little mind, it was this. I can't be alcoholic. How could I be alcoholic? When I don't drink, I end up in a straitjacket. When I don't drink, I'm going around looking for somebody to hurt me. When I don't drink, I can't sleep at night. When I don't do these things, I can't stand it. And I know what'll make the big hurt go away. And so I go seeking it out and finding it wherever I can find it. But I don't know, there was something about you. I've come to understand something very simple. I know it's a little simpler than most people think I am, but I'm awful simple. These people came to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't looking for them. I wasn't looking for them. And if I'd have known where I was going that day, I probably wouldn't have went. But something about you people who get up on Sunday morning and drive 100 and some miles up old back roads to talk to a bunch of people who don't want to listen to you. Something about that is attractive to a guy as desperate as I was. My curiosity got the best of me. And I remember one time I got up enough gumption to say something to one of those people. I said, what do you get out of coming up here anyhow? You like to look at the animals in the cages. What's your deal anyhow? And I remember this guy looked at me and smiled. And he said, son, when you can answer that question, you won't have to ask it. And that almost drove me insane. I didn't understand what he was talking about. But if you ever wonder what we do all this stuff for in Alcoholics Anonymous, when you can answer that question, you'll probably be doing some of it and you'll understand why we do it. I don't know. I just wandered around in this lost condition, not knowing I'm an alcoholic, but attracted to you people. One of those unknown mysteries that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day, a little guy that I knew did 23 right years in the penitentiary showed up there. And he told me something that all the great therapists and psychiatrists who've been working on me for 20 years didn't know. He didn't tell me if I just quit drinking, I'd be okay. He made this statement, I think, is the most amazing thing that he can make. He says, you don't have to live like this no more if you don't want to. That's my message to the newcomer. You don't have to do it like this no more. I didn't know that. Nobody ever. You know what people told me sitting across the desk from these great learned people? Told me if I didn't drink, I'd be all right. And I'm sitting there sober as I am right now in a straitjacket. I'm not, that's the way I end up being sober. I don't understand what's going on. After the meeting, I went up to this little man and I asked him, how do you learn how to live, Les? You see, I didn't want to know how to be sober from that day to this day and find this magnificent way of life that I've had for the last 60 some years of my life. Not at all. I want to know how I could lay down all night and sleep all night long without a nightmare, without some type of a high-powered sedative in my system. And his answer was very simple. Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. If you go get that book, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it. I went over to the prison library the next day and stole the book Alcoholics Anonymous because my big-time image didn't want anybody to see me doing better or trying to do better. They wanted me to stay as crazy as I was so I'd be beneficial to them. And I opened your book, Alcoholics Anonymous, not to get anything out of it or find an answer for anything. I was going to read your book. Then I was going to come to you and give my losing statement to all the losers. This is their statement. you don't understand, my case is different. You don't understand at all, you said my case is different. But I never got to it because part one night when I was laying there reading this book, I read the doctor's opinion. The doctor's opinion is the greatest description of what's wrong with me that's ever been put to pen by anybody, anywhere, everywhere. It talks about what happens to me when I drink. It talks about what happens to me when I don't drink. It talks about taking a drink, coming to the desire, taking a drink, and then the phenomenon of craving takes over. It's not in my system. The phenomenon is not in my system if there's no alcohol in there. And I don't know what it was, but somewhere in that night in the dark of that cell that I lived in, I assumed the responsibilities for my own action. And somehow or other, the book Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of recovery that's in that book was something that I just wanted to do. Because I thought maybe for a chance that maybe I could have some chance of something that I knew I was never going to be able to do outside of what I was doing. And so I went to the best of my ability, running around with that book under my arm in that penitentiary, getting all kinds of things from my little gang members, trying to change there. And then June the 4th, 1961, I walked out of the penitentiary as a confined convict for the last time in my life, I hope. Well, I go back to a lot of penitentiaries. I'm asked to go back to a lot of penitentiaries because I love going back to the penitentiary and seeing the people that I live with. I went home to see my mother. She fell off the steps blind drunk. I spent the next 30 years of my life watching my mother drink herself to death. If you haven't ever seen anything like that, I hope and pray to God that you never have to, and that you're so desperate that you want to see it. But there's something you can't do, and there's something you can't do about it. I had no power to help my mother. What I saw in that 30 years with my mother is I was trying to take care of her and take my two little children over to see her. What I was trying to do with my mother, I was trying to invoke some power in my mother that I wasn't capable of doing. My mother never even believed I was ever sober. My mother's action was, well, he was better after he quit running around with the Mexican gang. My mother always had an excuse for me to do something other than that. And I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for all these many years. And the greatest joy in my life is the people who have come to me over the years and asked me to help them. And I don't know whether I ever have anything to help anybody or not. But what I was taught by a guy, I went to a meeting one night, a guy by the name of Norm Alpe was talking. And I liked Norm because he came to the penitentiary to see me. And Norm spoke real fast that you couldn't keep up with him most of the time. But I loved him. And after the meeting, I went up to him and he said to me, I'm going to be your sponsor, Johnny. And I said, well, what's that? The book don't have nothing about no sponsor, baby. My little arrogant way. Well, you get sober doesn't mean your arrogance disappears somewhere or other down the line. And he said, well, I'm going to help you get things done that need to be done. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, why do you ask me? If I can't run my life, Johnny, what makes you think I can run yours? And I thought, well, now I'm disappointed and screwed over again. And I said, then what am I supposed to do? He said, why don't you just do what I do? And I said to him, what do you do? If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is what sponsorship is. If you do what your sponsor does, you'll be all right. And there's no way in the world, if Norm Alpe was still alive, he'd have probably still been my sponsor. But he died on my 22nd birthday and Clancy took over. We had some type of a big brother, little brother relationship with Clancy. I loved him and I almost became a part of his family so much I was so close to him. But doing things in life the joy that I've had is trying to carry this message of Alcoholics Anonymous to the alcoholic who still suffers, with no sharp, no idea of ever getting anything in return. I just don't seem to understand how a free gift given to me could be sold to somebody else. I just never have been able to buy into that concept. And I'm not telling you every day's been roses. I've just never did things. I've got myself in jackpots because I wasn't supposed to. I've done things that I wasn't supposed to because my ego takes over and runs it. You know, I cheated on my wife, you know, but I didn't stay cheated on my wife. I went home and moved my clothes off because I knew if I did it once and got away with it, I'd do it again. I've always known that. And so I've been in for the last 25 years now, I've been married to Karen, and we've got a wonderful relationship. My children have all grown up. My daughter, who showed up at my doorstep one night, 20-some-odd years ago, in the rain with nothing. She'd been suspended from her job at Boeing, where she worked. They'd taken her son, my grandson, away from her because she couldn't take care of him. And she said this to me. She said, "Daddy, can I come here and stay?" And I said, "Well, here are the rules. You're going to get you a sponsor, and you're going to do what that sponsor has to say, or you can turn around and go right back out there in the rain." You know what she did? She went and got Karen Garrison for a sponsor. And Karen Garrison turned her into a productive, happy, joyous little human being who went back to school and graduated. And when she retired from Boeing, she went to law school to become an attorney. Now she's living in Kauai and working for the police department. And when she said, "I got a job at the police department, some type of administrator or something," I said, "You didn't tell him you knew me and give him my name, did you?" Because I'd probably spin it. But my life has been a fairy tale. It's been things are, you know, the people who've come into my life. Here's the thing that I miss on Wednesday night. I miss it on Monday night too. But Wednesday night is special because I was sitting next to my sponsor for 30 some odd years. Here's what I get. I see God's grace, and I miss this more than anything. I miss it more than the speaker. I miss it more than the 10-minute speaker. I miss it more than anything. I like the fellowship. But my joy is to watch people get up on the podium in their suits and ties and the women in their dresses and take their birthday cake and say their gratitude to God and to Alcoholics Anonymous and their sponsor. And what that is to me, that's God speaking through people. That is God's evidence here in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you knew that this thing works. It worked for an alcoholic when nothing else ever has and never will. Even though we have people trying to change everything, it still works to the people that it has worked for. And Monday night is the same thing. Monday night, my home group, when I go down there, I sit and wait for my favorite part of the meeting, when those people stand up there and take their birthday cakes. You know, I love a lot of people and I enjoy a lot of speakers, but I sit in a meeting, you know, and Clancy would always put his arm on my shoulder when that happened, knew that what was going to happen is that I was going to see God's evidence in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And hey, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, the word is God. It is not a doorknob. It is not some type of a barn door somewhere. I don't even like the word higher power. I like the word that it says in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it God. That seems to be his name. And I didn't understand. I know some people use it and use it bluntly and all that. But I like the word God. I've got very comfortable with it. And I got things. I had a great teacher about that. He was Clancy's sponsor. He was my father. And he taught me about things that fathers teach their children. that I didn't have the opportunity of when I was growing up. All I had was counselors and guards down like that that were running my life. But he taught me about a love that one alcoholic has for another. He showed me this unconditional love that no matter what kind of a jackpot I got into or what matter what he did, I loved him. See, I loved Clancy that way. I loved Clancy unconditionally with all his little warts and everything. I still loved him unconditionally. And so was this thing with me. And my Papa Chuck gave me a little prayer. I say every day when I get in my car and go out to wherever I'm going to go to work. After I've done my reading in my 24-hour day book and a couple of other books that I like very much, it puts me in touch with my sobriety on a day basis. I listen to my phone calls from the people that I love, that I sponsor. And I just go out there. This is my little prayer. I know this is a little simple for a lot of geniuses, but it just suits me real fine because one or two electroshock treatments will take care of a lot of your intellect. You don't have to worry about it. This is the prayer. Okay, Pop, I'm going to go out there and move it around all day. I hope I don't get me in anything you can't get us out of. Amen. I'm very, very pleased. I've known Marty and his sister ever since they first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've loved them dearly as they followed me all over Riverside from time to time. So thank you, Marty, for the job you've done as secretary of the Pacific Group. And thank you for the great invitation. And all you people that I miss so much, I hope we get together soon. So until that time's come, keep a stiff upper lip and away you go. Carry the message to the alcoholic in any way you can. Thank you for having me, and I'll see you on Zoom, if not anything else. Bye-bye.
Thank you. May we now have the announcements from our secretary.
We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything that would affect you from the neck up. If you're regular attended this meeting and like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me be of service this year.
Please email the birthday person by 6:30. Otherwise, you have to wait until the following week to get recognized. This week, we have a special guest to play us a happy birthday song.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you, Marty. This is for Marty, and this is for all the birthday participants, and this is for Clancy and my dad.
Speechless. Okay. Our birthdays this week are Sonomi for 1 year. Her sponsor is Yuko P. Rigo S for 7 years. His sponsor is Chris N. Terry W for 23 years. Her sponsor is Susie A. Hillary R for 24 years. Her sponsor is Polly P. Richard C for 31 years. His sponsor is Tom B. Chris N for 34 years, his sponsor is Tom B. Carol T for 36 years, her sponsor is Annika H. Diane S for 48 years, her sponsor is Roz G. Nancy M, former secretary for 50 years, her sponsor is Ginny D. Joanne L for 51 years, her sponsor is Joan S. Marlena B. for 54 years. Her sponsor is Dottie A. So we had 11 birthdays for a total of 359 years, averaging 32.63 years per cake. Happy birthday, recipients. We have a custom of the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes at the end of the year. This candle money is our contributions to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.